All right, hello, welcome to the At YouTube podcast. We've reached episode number 007, the podcast where we talk all things YouTube, including album news, tour dates, community discussions from the staff of atyoutube.com. And I'm joined once again by Mr. Matt McGee. Hello, Matt.
Hey, Chris, how are you, sir?
I am well. How are you doing?
I'm doing fantastic.
Yeah, it's weeks away, week and a half away of the tour starting again. So it feels like we just barely got a break and we're already back ready to go for the new tour, new start of the
tour. I know. It's very exciting. My wife saw a tweet. I sent out a tweet about a week or 10 days ago, and I sent it out at like 1 a.m, knowing that no one would see it, particularly her. And I said, don't tell my wife, but I've already started researching airfares to every city on the European tour. So she actually ended up seeing that tweet. So, you know, we'll see what happens. I'm still looking at airfares. But
well, I would assume you've got a birthday or something coming up. She's probably going to buy you tickets. I would assume that would sort of happen.
I actually do have a birthday coming up, and I will mention that to her.
Yeah. Podcast advice given and received. All good. And this will be the last time Matt's on the podcast. He's been banned from the show.
What if we do like a Kickstarter to send the At U2 crew around Europe to follow the tour? That would be awesome.
Well, first of all, we're doing the Tattoo Matt Kickstarter project, right? That's what we figured out last episode.
Oh, gosh, don't remind me.
Speaking of random pictures on things, which this is that's a terrible segue, but U2's on their break right now, and they're actually posting a little more to like Instagram and stuff, albeit through it feels a bit like through a handler or through how your dad might post to Twitter or Instagram in a way.
Yeah, I was wondering about that. Like, are they posting it themselves or do they have somebody doing it? But then there was the photo that Adam posted just a couple days ago where he's like, you know, dressed to the nines, right? And yeah. In you know, the tie and the outfit, and it's him in a mirror and you can see him holding the camera taking the photo himself. So
yeah, wow. So who knows? I mean, maybe they're getting braver as they do this.
I love the idea of, you know, just Adam or Larry kind of shifting through the different screens on their phone. Where's the Instagram app? Oh, there it is. You know, log in, shoot the photo. Now I got to type a caption. I just love the image of that.
Yeah, exactly. And it is unusual. I know I was on, I forget where I was. I had limited Wi-Fi and no cell connection or vice versa. But I saw the tweet go by of like the U2 from the U2 account, suited, booted Adam. And then I couldn't load the picture. It wasn't loading, but I just saw predominantly women, but you know, people responding saying, oh my gosh, oh wow.
I know, he looked fantastic.
Which you don't usually see Adam in a suit first, like an actual suit. You see him in other kinds of suits.
Right.
So anyway, there you go. It's linked in the show notes, which you can find at goodstuff.fm/atu2/7. So if you haven't seen Adam suited, booted, there he is. And they do, yeah, they often sign it with, you know, initials or whatever as is common, or just their name, Edge or whatever. Bono had a good one with the sunglasses on. I know someone, I forget who it was, maybe Tasula, was saying like the return of the fly kind of thing. But yeah, it's I feel like a long time coming. I don't want to look a gift horse in the mouth or complain about a horse or whatever the saying is, but and just enjoy the little peek we get into some of
I agree.
Post-outside tour life.
It's kind of like right on the 360 tour when Edge was doing Twitter and all he would do is post photos. He wouldn't ever, you know, say anything. I guess it kind of makes sense that they would use Instagram that way because that's, you know, exactly what you use Instagram for. So yeah, I agree with you. It's really cool to see that they're sort of opening that door a little bit the way they are.
Yeah. All right, well, let's jump right into our inbox. We have a roundtable discussion coming up in a bit with a couple of guests from international places around the world.
Yes.
And so we want to save lots of time for that. So we'll just do a couple of questions from our hashtag AskAtU2 questions that listeners have been awesome at sending in. We have tons right now. There's some that we won't get to this episode that we'll save for a future episode, but definitely feel free to keep sending them in. At Michael Colligan, sorry, again, I won't butcher your name. That's just a guarantee. Asked a question about some personal stuff and getting in touch with Adam and Bono and Larry and the Edge. And Matt, maybe you can speak to this a bit, but I'll just say, you know, we at the podcast side of things definitely don't have any great connection, super instant connection with you two themselves, the band, the management, et cetera. And so it's not a vehicle that or a way, a great way to get in touch with them that way.
Yeah, it's we get a lot of emails too, you know, via the website, you know, direct to me or direct to somebody else on staff with people making, you know, personal requests like, can you get a message to Bono? Can you get a message to the Edge or whatever? Or can, is there a way that, you know, you can help me contact the band so we can, you know, do a wedding proposal in the middle of the concert and all this sort of stuff. And then there's also, you know, some really heartfelt ones that come in, you know, where, you know, somebody's son or daughter or dad or mom or, you know, in poor health and can you, we get a message from the band. And, you know, they're really heartbreaking emails, but, you know, the sad part is we don't have a way to, you know, other than, you know, saying prayers and, you know, maybe trying to direct them to the U2.com message boards or something like that. There's just, we don't have a direct connection to the band like that we could, you know, that we can pass those messages along. So,
yeah. So the, you know, the channels that you may be aware of, Twitter, U2 on Twitter and the Zootopia forum on U2.com, which we'll put links to in the show notes. And, that's, I guess, your best bet, just like the rest of us are sort of. And, we do, like, as listeners of the podcast, we love all of you and obviously, and are, like Matt said, heartbroken when life is hard and celebrating with you and life is awesome and getting up on stage or getting to a show and all that kind of stuff. We love hearing from you, but just know that we can't, do anything much more than join in
with right. your sympathy and empathy. Right?
Yeah, exactly. Infamous from episode 6 of the YouTube podcast, Beth and Bono asked, do you think there's any benefit for fans in Ticketmaster's new Ticketmaster Plus resale? I don't. I think it's legitimized scalping and Ticketmaster's attempt to get a cut of the secondary market. I don't know what this is, Matt, but you might have feelings?
Well, I mean, she's absolutely right. It's totally legitimized scalping, and it's very much an attempt to get a cut of the secondary market because Ticketmaster used to not have that that resale market. It used to be something you had to do through StubHub and through sites like that. And there's a ton of money to be made in that. Is there any benefit for fans? Well, I think there is, just to the degree that at least if you buy through the Ticketmaster resale through the official site, you know that you are getting a legitimate ticket that is going to get you in the venue. Whereas if you are buying through Craigslist or eBay or, you know, some guy on the street or something, you know, outside the venue, you have no idea if what you're buying is an actual ticket. And one of our good friends of at U2, Justin Kent, he got in trouble with that. I think it was at one of the New York shows where he, or maybe it was earlier in the tour, I can't recall which city it was, but he bought a ticket from, you know, a scalper and it ended up being a fake and he was out of luck. He was out of several hundred dollars. So yeah, I mean, it's definitely legitimized scalping. On the bright side, you know that you're going to get in if you spend that money. I mean, look, I wasn't happy. I spent $400 on a GA for New York number 7. And I was not thrilled at all about having to spend that much money, but at least I knew that I was getting a ticket and I was, you know, my son was going to be in there with me and we didn't have to worry about, you know, is the tickets going to scan? Is it a fake? Blah, 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 blah. So, yeah, I mean, look, it's there's some benefit, but, you know, it's not the best situation in the world.
All right. Now we bring us to a little segment.
Here we go.
I was calling Listeners Argue with Matt, but I think we'll come up with a new segment or name for it called...
Do I have to answer that again?
Wait, say that again?
Do I have to answer that again?
Do I have to answer that again? Okay.
Where Matt has said something in the past, listeners want a little bit of follow-up or posted something on at u2.com, an article or things like that. Listeners just want to, and the readers want a follow up question saying, okay, so for example, at CKONANZ.
That's Christian. We had Christian answer or asked a question on the last podcast, right?
See, and I will mispronounce your name. I will also promptly forget your name. That's
really rude.
So I have a guarantee.
Yes.
I blame my kids for that.
See, Conan's, I think, is Christian.
There we go. Matt, you mentioned on October 2014, so this is going back a little ways now. They're keeping a book on you, Matt, that Songs of Innocence had some awful songs. Which were those songs? Do you still think they're awful? I love this question.
Can we just skip that?
Do I have to answer that again?
No, you're being held. Your toes are being held to the fire by Christian here.
See, the problem is, like, I love, like, one of my favorite songs on Songs of Innocence is California. And some of my best friends in the world hate that song and think it's terrible and talk crap about that song. And I actually started, they were so hateful towards California that I started taking it personally. And I was like, questioning my own fandom and my own tastes in U2 songs. Like, wait, these are my friends and they hate the song. Like, what's wrong with me if I love this song? And so I've purposely avoided not saying what songs from Songs of Innocence I hate because I have very good friends that love these songs. And so I don't want I don't want them to feel the way I felt, Chris.
I don't know, listeners. I'm Matt squirming here trying to get out of this. I'm not sure where they're pressed.
You really want me to answer this, right?
I think the listeners, I can't hear them audibly right now, but I'm pretty sure they do. They're begging for it, cheering or ranting or whatever.
All right. I'm just going to leave this here.
Drop of megalomania, touch of generosity, dash of self-promotion.
Stop doing that.
That wasn't a matter, if you can't tell.
It's scary that you control the audio here.
All right. So what are the awful songs?
Okay. Volcano is such an unbelievably bad song. There are no words for how bad Volcano is. But I have some very good friends that love it, and I want them to keep loving it. And I don't want them to feel like every time they hear Volcano, oh, well, Matt hates this song, blah, blah, blah. So anyway, Volcano's terrible. And Sleep Like a Baby Tonight, I cannot even bear to listen to. Like Volcano, if it comes on and, you know, I listen to it, whatever. It's not the end of the world. But Sleep Like a Baby Tonight, I can't even bear to listen to that. That's just like skip immediately. Let's go past. So those are my two least favorite. And I'll add that I did not like Raised by Wolves in the beginning until the tour came along. And then, as often happens, you know, once you hear a song live, it takes on a new, you know, a new sort of atmosphere, a new vibe, that sort of thing. And so I've come to, you know, really like Raised by Wolves now. I did not like it in the beginning. So, Christian, I hope that answers your question. And I apologize to everyone that likes those two songs. I don't like them.
Get it all out the edge.
You're almost sounding a little bit, you might get the honorary Canadian tag for apologizing profusely for having
your
opinion.
Influence. It's your influence.
All right. Well, there you go. I know. I think many U2 fans can identify with that, especially the angle of like hearing it on the record or the CD or whatever, and then hearing it live and your opinion changes. Dirty Day was that way for me on the album. It's not that I hated it on Zooropa, but once I saw ZooTV tour, etc., and heard it being played live, it was kind of like this was a new song to me. So
you know what else I don't like.
Uh-oh, here we go. I opened up a valve.
Lucifer's Hands and Crystal Ballroom, I can't stand them.
Really?
And I know everyone loves the Crystal Ballroom as a song. I don't understand what everybody likes about the song, and I've tried so hard to get into that song. I can't get into that song. So
what's your Twitter account again, Matt? I forget.
At Matt McGee.
Okay, so there you go.
I know, I'm going to get it. I'm going to get it in email. I'm going to get it on Twitter. I'm going to hear it everywhere. I know.
And you can. We have the ask at U2 hashtag. If you need to, like, just put an extra exclamation point that you want it for this,
do I have to answer that again?
Segment. Maybe we'll put a little extra hashtag of Ask Matt or something on there. You guys be creative in your responses.
You can use like hashtag Matt is an idiot or whatever. You know, that's fine.
No, we want to be nice. I don't want Matt to feel bad. Okay, the second question from Sunkissed PTA was, Matt said he didn't like how Streets was played. How has it changed over the tours? I like Pop Mart Streets best. So I know you've been, I think it was on the podcast with me for sure. And then before that, I remember you mentioning that. So it's obviously something where you've got
when we had Beth and Chris on last week, I think we talked about this. Streets has been my favorite song forever, and it's the one song I could never live without. But and Beth and I talked about this offline. It's just, and some people have said on Twitter, and so what I'm about to say is not original by any means, because I remember you know, as we're live tweeting the concerts, you know, the last couple months, people have been talking about this. But I agree with whoever it was that first said this, and with all the people that said it, it doesn't have the same strength this tour because there's sort of the hard stop before it, and then Bono, you know, talks for about 3 minutes about the you know, the One Campaign stuff and the retroviral drugs and all that sort of stuff, and then it goes into the Paul Simon song that, you know, frankly I was not familiar with at all before the tour started, and so it doesn't have the right, you know, for me it doesn't have the right lead in. It doesn't sort of, you know, carry that momentum that I usually want it to carry. And, you know, look, I love what U2 does with, you know, and what Bono specifically does with all the humanitarian stuff. But Streets to me is sort of like a sacred thing. And I will not associate Streets with the One Campaign and the Africa stuff. That it's too personal of a song to me. And so I didn't like it on the Vertigo tour when it was, when they had the African flags coming down. It's not that I'm, you know, opposed to all the good that he's done there. I just, that song to me is, it's like, don't touch that song. Leave that, you know, I'm being selfish U2 fan when I say that, but that's just,
yeah,
that's just sort of, you know, what has been for me, you know, my struggle with Streets on this tour. And so Bad has kind of replaced it on this tour. The few times they've done Bad, it's just been an absolute religious experience on this tour. So.
And so it's not even so much the, as a guitarist, I was curious if it was more like the instrumentation, or maybe they've, you know, dropped one of the level of the synth sounder or something, and, you know, it wasn't as, didn't have the same kind of oomph that maybe other tours have had. It's more about just the atmosphere and the theme of the song surrounding it, the packaging almost, than the actual song itself.
Exactly. I think that's a good way to describe it, yes.
Yeah. Which I think is fair, totally, because it definitely is like that, and Bad, like you said, are both songs that are very, like, defining songs of how a tour feels almost, and when they play those songs, that kind of signals how you might feel, not necessarily about the rest of the tour, I guess, but just that those are defining songs that
when you have a real personal connection with a song, you know, that it already has a lot of baggage and weight and value internally for you,
yeah,
and then for it to suddenly be presented in a whole different way, it's just there's sort of takes some getting used to, and I just haven't gotten around to appreciating the way that it's being presented on this tour.
Sure. All right. Well, that ends.
Do I have to answer that again?
With Matt this time. And like I said, be sure to send in future questions if you have them. We won't do it every time, but only if there's an appropriate question to follow up with Matt. All right. Well, in lieu of our shortened discussion right now, we'll have a little longer discussion on our At U2 Roundtable, which we'll just jump right into because I think we do a good job of introducing the guests that are on the show, and then Matt and I will be back after the roundtable to wrap up any sort of loose ends.
Yeah, hey, baby, stand by for a zoo, radio transmit.
All right, welcome to the official At U2 Roundtable discussion. Matt, who do we have today at the virtual roundtable?
We have the most international gathering of U2 fans that we may ever have on the podcast, right?
Yeah, I didn't do a very Google Map check, but yeah, I think
it's very exciting. We have we have a special guest coming to us from. Well, I'll let him say where he's from right now, but it's Navid, who is a member of the U2Tour.de fan site staff. And then we also have, from our own At U2 crew, we have Aaron Govern, who is also not in North America. So we have very international things. Navid, why don't you go first? Tell us where you are and how and when you became a U2 fan. Just sort of introduce yourself to our listeners.
Sure. First, hi, Matt. Hi, Chris. As said, I'm from the staff of U2 Tour D, your German counterpart. I'm from Vienna, Austria, and currently residing in Istanbul. So it is quite an international round. And how I first stumbled across U2, I guess it's got to be my older brothers, just seeing them listen to Rattle and Hum and Under a Blood Red Sky. And then the first album that brought me in was Achtung Baby, which I guess was the one for most of us. And to this day, I'll name Who's Gonna Ride Your Wild Horses as one of my favorite songs. I think that was around 92, I guess. And that really did it for me back then. I'm still a little bit bummed that I missed out the tour. the Zoo TV tour because I decided to go to a Guns N' Roses concert instead.
Nice.
But bad choice.
Oh, no.
But one tour later, they had me.
Excellent. And so, Aaron, you are home is England, but you are also traveling at the moment. So why don't you introduce yourself to our listeners and where you are right now and how long and how you got into being a U2 fan?
Hi, Matt. Hi, Chris. Hi, listeners. Well, currently I'm in a hotel room in the Dominican Republic on vacation, but my normal place of residence is central England in the county of Warwickshire in England. I've worked with the Matt and the At U2 website now for just over 5 years. I'm still not sure what I do for the website. I do many things. And Matt, I'm sure you don't know what I do. But I've been a long-term fan now of U2 for over 32, 33 years, pretty much prior to war, actually, in between October and before war came out. Pretty much every band I was into at the time were a guitar-based band. So if it wasn't U2, it was Echo and the Bunnymen or Simple Minds. So I come from that era of music fandom. I think I've probably seen U2 now just over 100 times. It's a ridiculous amount of times. I know there's many U2 fans out there like that, but it's almost become an obsession for me. I haven't seen U2 on this tour so far, albeit I have watched probably every concert on YouTube. Who hasn't? It's pretty much out there at the moment. But looking forward to the start of the European tour in a few weeks' time.
Aaron, you haven't seen the current tour. Navid, how about you? Have you seen stops on this current tour already?
I've been to Vancouver and the last two New York shows I've seen so far. So four in total, I guess, yeah.
You saw the beginning and the end. I was at those four shows as well, the first two and then the last two. What was your impression, Navid, of those four shows and how the tour itself, the concerts, sort of changed from Vancouver to New York?
Okay. Generally, I have to say on this tour, just watching them enjoy themselves, it's nowhere near that they're being tired of being dull. Or just watching Edge jump up and down all over the stage during I Will Follow, one of their war horses. You know, it's incredible. I think the new songs like Iris, Raised by Wolves, Cedarwood Road, they're really all made for a live show. And usually that's what U2 is about, that, you know, when you go back and rather listen to a bootleg of a song rather than listening to the album version. And just think about, I don't know, Mofo or Beautiful Day or Love is Blindness. And those songs really connect and get together live. And I didn't have the feeling on the last two tours, to be honest. Just thinking back about Magnificence or A Miracle Drug. So yeah, there's something about this tour and this album, I have to say, for me personally, which I think is working great. And it's interesting to see how they change things over time, being to the first two Vancouver shows and the last two New York shows. It didn't take them long to drop Miracle Drug all of a sudden because they realize it's not connecting well as an opener for the encores, or the Troubles is not going to work, so let's just drop that. Unfortunately, they dropped it for good, but that's another story. Or even the intermission part with the, you know, they put a yellow screen and eventually they've built up the Berlin Wall and playing the Fly remix from Gavin Friday. So it's nice to see them, how they fine-tune the show over time. I personally had a great time at all four shows. I think the tour is great. They're in a really good mood, as said. Even the War Horses sound as fresh as ever. Had a great time so far.
That's a common thing that I think I've said, and a lot of our crew has said, and people, you know, that we talk to at the shows and all that, that songs like Pride and Bullet the Blue Sky and, you know, the Warhorse songs that, you know, as you were saying, I don't know what it is. Like, is it that the band is playing them differently, or is that they're just a different energy for some reason in the room? But like Pride in particular, just for whatever reason, really stands out as one of those songs on this tour where you kind of maybe expected, oh, I don't want to have to hear that again. But man, it sounds really good. And the audience is so into it.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. As you say, the old songs, I mean, personally, I have to say, I Will Follow just blows me away every time. That song is really made for indoor arenas. And Pride as well. And one of my personal highlights, although by no means am I a fan of the song itself, but Bullet really blows me away. I think the break during the 360 tour did really well. And the version they're playing right now is just breathtaking. It's really one of the highlights for me of the show. So, yeah, I don't know what it is. I do think there's just, you know, we always speak of U2 being a stadium band, but really indoors is where they belong and where these songs stand out and are made for some reason.
So one of the things that we want to talk about, since U2, well, U2, YOU, TWO, are European-based fans, is I'd like to know what you guys think is going to happen when the tour starts, what, next? Next, is it next week already? It's the end of next week, I guess, right?
Yeah, 10 days.
Exactly. So when the tour gets to Italy, what kind of changes do you expect to see when the tour gets into Italy?
Well, I mean, thinking about what's happened over the last 2 or 3 months in America, they've clearly road tested most of Songs of Innocence, and clearly some songs like The Troubles are probably not going to be played in Europe, if not again. From what I can understand and seeing them on YouTube, they certainly didn't suit the mood of the show as such. But I think what may happen with the remaining part of the tour, certainly in Europe, is they may experiment a bit more like they did in 2010 on the second leg of the 360 tour and may introduce some new songs. If you go back to 2010, some of the new songs that had been played eventually ended up on Songs of Innocence. Certainly Every Breaking Wave got through. And we know we even heard Mercy, albeit that goes back to the prior recording of that album. But songs like North Star were played as well. So I don't know. We may hear some a bit more experimentation, in my opinion.
You mentioned The Troubles a couple times, thinking that it wouldn't play very well over Europe. Do you think, is that just based on the North American reaction to the song, or do you think just thematically and stuff, it's just not really working? And we're all, like we said before on the show, we're all about conjecture and guessing and speculation. Like we're not Willie Williams or Bono in this discussion. So feel free to throw a song under the bus if you need to, or whatever, and we'll deal with the hate mail later.
Yeah, it's always a little bit difficult to speculate. I do wonder as well on the impact of the venues in Europe. I don't think they'll be as big physically as the American sports arenas are. So that may bring a bit more intimacy to the shows. I'm not sure what may or may happen in terms of crowd reaction. Certainly, there's going to be different reaction because there's so many different cultures they're going to be playing to. I mean, if you look at the tour as it stands, they've got Italy, Holland, Sweden, Germany, Spain, Belgium. And then, of course, we've got in the UK, we've got England and Scotland, and then finally in France. So there's going to be a lot of different different types of audience reaction, and also different reaction from the band to each of their fans in those countries. So I think it's going to be very interesting as time progresses, certainly in the same way that the shows differed from Vancouver right through to New York. I think we're going to see a similar situation happen in Europe.
Now, but how about you in this? What do you anticipate sort of happening here with the European leg of the tour now?
I don't think they will change much. I think, you know, they have a tour concept, and, you know, probably for the first time since, I don't know, I guess Elevation, with the entire going back and with the heart. So I think the first part of the, you know, up until they reach the East stage, I don't think they'll change much there. They might change the occasional second song or something. I think we'll probably get to hear something like New Year's Day at some point. But I don't think they'll change much. Obviously, the parts they will have to fine tune is things like, I don't know, The Hands That Build America. I'm pretty sure they will change that for Europe. But I don't think we'll see much of a change this year on this leg in Europe, to be honest. We've seen the screenshots of the soundboard of songs they might have rehearsed, and they have rehearsed some songs which we haven't heard yet. But same happened 6 years ago and during the 360 tour where they also rehearsed a couple of songs and we never heard, like Drowning Man, I think it was. So yeah, I'm not that optimistic that it'll change much, but we'll see.
We could sort of break this down. I'm tending to agree with what Navid was just saying. So like the first half of the show, right? It starts with the four songs where they're just playing under the light bulb, and it's sort of the early 80s club vibe. I think we can assume that that's going to continue, that they're going to open the European shows with, you know, four songs. They may alternate, you know, one or two of them out, from time to time. Right. And then after that, the rest of that first set from Iris through Until the End of the World, I don't think that's going to change. I don't think that's going to change at all in Europe. Do you guys?
No, I don't. I'll think it'll even go further than Until the End of the World. It'll go right through mysterious ways when they really actually physically reach the East Stage. I don't think they'll change anything up until that point.
Okay.
Yeah, I think I tend to agree. I think the second song is clearly the place where they're going to introduce some changes. But beyond that, yeah, I think really just in the first half, the whole of the Songs of Experience and Songs of Innocence song set starts being played, and I think it's going to fit in with the concept. And I don't think they'll change it in that respect.
You guys, you mentioned also, Navid, the segment of the show it's in the second set where Bonos does that snippet of Hands That Built America, and there's several, you know, very specific U.S. based references when he talks about, you know, what happened in Ferguson, what happened in Baltimore, things like that. I remember those actually didn't go over too well when U2 was playing, you know, just north of the border in Canada. So, I mean, I agree with you 100% that is going to have to change up for the European tour. Pardon me for not knowing what's going on, you know, maybe as well as I should, what's in the news in Europe, but are there things like that he could replace that with for each different European audience?
I think so. There's just been some terrorism attacks within France, or an attempted terrorism attack in France. There's been numerous others, if not in recent years, certainly London, going back to 2005, we had the terrible terrorism attack. So I think that, yeah, you could replace some of the references, no problem.
No, I tend to agree. I mean, there's certainly be enough material for references, but again, I'm just trying to connect them with songs, and there's nothing specific that would come to my mind. With Pride, you obviously have the connection, but I'm trying to think of songs that could fit in into those segments to make that work, and can't really think of anything except for maybe something like Running to Stansted or something. But
difficult. Sunday Bloody Sunday is always an opportunity. It's not always relating to Ireland. It can relate to any particular country.
Is it, and this may be a very North American-centric question or point of view, I guess, but it feels like their approach in the U.S., North America, and I'm Canadian, so I can throw ourselves in with the U.S., I guess, there, but like in North America anyways, is like we're trying to reach you and let you know about stuff, whereas in Europe it feels like the vibe is a bit more, and I've never been to a U2 stop in Europe, so this is very out of my knowledge base here, but it feels like it's a bit more of like you're a little more aware of stuff, and we have to be they tread a little more carefully with how they touch on different political nerves and stuff like that. Is that a fair assessment, or am I out to lunch?
No, I think that's a fair assessment. It's pretty much the case. It's been like that with U2 for a long, long time, I think. Bono is very active in lots of different respects, and very culture orientated. I think he's able to be very versatile in the way that he works with his audiences, and I think we've seen that over many, many years.
Based on both of your experiences in seeing shows around Europe, which I assume you both have done, are the audiences, you know, different in their response to U2, you know, say between Paris and Barcelona, or you know, London and Berlin? Does U2 get a different response based on what country they're in?
Oh, for sure. Absolutely, for sure. I mean, I've been to see you two in Spain and Italy, and the passion is incredible. In the UK, certainly my experience is that the London audiences tend to be a little bit more laid back, tend to be a bit trying to be cool about the whole thing. But I see a lot of passion amongst the Italians and the Spanish. Even Germany, the direction has been incredible to the extent that I just didn't expect it when I saw them in there. I think the passion is going to be quite different again when we see you two playing indoors. Because, I mean, I think this is really the first time in 14 years that you two played indoors in Europe. So I think we're going to get a much more different reaction. Some of the shows that I went to on Vertigo and 360 in Europe, there was less focus. I guess it depends where you're standing or sitting at those shows. But sometimes your mind just drifts away because people in front of you are talking. They've got their mobile phones out, and there's less attention being paid. Whereas I think the indoor shows, I think it's because it's darker. There's less issues in terms of distraction. I think that's going to make a massive difference to how the audience reacts.
I agree. You often do hear, you know, the shows in Europe. And the audiences might go up a little more, and especially when we talk about any shows, as Aaron mentioned, in Italy or Spain that I've been to, really the crowd reaction always is something different. And even some other cities where you can always expect good shows from you, to, like, as you mentioned, Paris, for instance, or Amsterdam, where I've been to during the Vertigo Tour and 360, and really outstanding. So I've seen all these places through the last two tours and had a great time. But then again, as Aaron says, it really depends where you are standing or where you're sitting. Personally, for instance, I remember during the 360 tour, Berlin was one of the highlights of the tour for me. But Dublin, which is like the holy grail, I guess, for any U2 fan to go to, everyone would always talk about Slane. But the 360 concerts, I remember I left Dublin with a slight disappointment that they were quite ordinary. So yeah, it'll depend where you're standing or sitting. But generally speaking, places like Italy and Spain and Europe, you can't go wrong for sure.
You bring up a good point, maybe, that we could segue to the idea of where to sit and stuff like that. And a listener of the show at Sunkissed PTA asked us through our Ask at U2 hashtag on Twitter, info on behind scenes of U2 concerts, time they show up, what happens before they go on, and how soon do they leave the show? And sort of the general advice of giving fans, you know, now in Europe, when to get in line, where do you think the best place to stand, sit is, and the question I probably ask every time, I think, so far is, you know, if you can only attend one show, where would you go and sit? And Navid, I guess you've had the advantage in this discussion, I guess, as far as actually having been to the show and now sort of planning out your European vacation, U2 vacation of sorts.
Everything planned, yeah.
what are your thoughts on just like the day of a U2 show? What advice would you give to fans if this is their first time maybe seeing U2 or they're looking to sort of, maybe they've seen them before but want to just be able to, you know, catch them on the drive-in like they see photos of on Twitter or whatever and some of that kind of stuff?
During the North American shows now, I haven't done any GA so far yet. So I've been only two seats. As of GA line, I won't be able to comment on that. Usually, from my experience in Europe, you'll queue much longer than you do in the US, I guess. But talking about seating and where you have the best seats in the house, I've been to about every place now in indoors. And we always speak about there not being any bad seats, but that's obviously not really going to be true because I sat behind the stage, I sat across the stage, I sat next to the stage so you could see the screen. And sitting behind the stage, you know, dead center, the first Vancouver show I remember, everyone was left and right freaking out during the songs, and I was just wondering what it's all about until I actually saw the show a couple of days later on the screen. So, you know, the expensive seats obviously are going to be the best seats because a major part of the show is the visuals, the things you see during Until the End of the World or some of the other songs like Cedarwood Road. If you don't see that, then you're sitting at a dead angle and can't experience that. That's, you're kind of missing the point of the entire show somehow. And then GA, you know, you'll probably be as close as you can ever be to them, because the catwalk and the B stage, you know, it just stretches and goes on and on. So you're going to be as close as ever to the band. Again, you're probably going to be too close to actually see the screen and see what's going on. But you'll always have pros and cons. So,
well, from my perspective, I'm actually quite pleased with the tickets I've ended up with for the O2. I'm going to all six shows currently. Hopefully going to go to a few more shows, perhaps up in Glasgow. But when I apply for my tickets, I managed to get 3 GAs and 3 seats. So having listened to the previous podcasts and spoken to a few of the staff members, I think most of them are saying really that you can get far too close to GA and you can't really see the screen so well. And this is very much a concept tour, probably the first concept tour you two have generally done. So I'm quite pleased that I've got a different view each night, a different way of looking at the band play and soak up the atmosphere in different respects. So I'm quite pleased with that. The other aspect also as well, I'm getting older now, and, you know, on the Zoo TV tour, I was quite pleased to queue up outside the Burm NEC for 26 hours prior to the to the show starting. Now I can't do that. I can last 26 minutes, not 26 hours. So I'm really very pleased from what I'm hearing that, you know, the GA doesn't really matter. You can turn up as late as you want almost, and you can, you know, you can just stand where you want. That pleases me no end, I have to say.
Yeah, and I'll just echo that for anybody that, you know, for whatever reason hasn't, you know, listened to the previous podcasts or seen any of the articles that have been published or whatever. I mean, you at the shows that you know that I went to, what was it, Vancouver, and then I did it again in Phoenix. You know, like didn't line up all day, just went to the arena at about 6:30 or 7 o'clock. The GA line had already started getting let in. Went in, and I could get a spot, you know, two or three people back from the rail at the E stage, just, you know, by showing up at 7 o'clock for a show that starts at 8. So, you know, I think, you know, I just echo what Aaron was just saying, that, you know, unless you absolutely need to be in one specific spot on the floor, you know, up against the rail or what have you, I don't think there's really any reason to spend all day in the GA line. And so, but again, I'm not... maybe things will be different in Europe. I don't know. I know that, you know, here in North America, with the amount of people that lined up and that sort of stuff, it was still pretty comfortable to just show up at 6:30, 7 o'clock and get pretty much anywhere you wanted to go.
And the fans who, I guess for those fans who are about to write Matt an email, there is still value in getting together and having fun. Matt's not against fun.
It's true.
There is, I know there's community that happens on in the line, but there's also tired legs and smelly armpits or whatever. I don't know. Right,
exactly. I think that the lines are great, because it never ceases to amaze me. People you haven't seen for 5-6 years, we all get a bit more gray hair, perhaps even a little bit less hair. But you meet people you haven't seen for a long, long time. You don't even know the names, actually, to be honest with you, but you just think, oh, I haven't seen you for a while. How are you? And you just carry on that conversation as if nothing's happened in between. It's just amazing.
I have a question for Navid and Aaron. Just again, not ever having been to a European show, I don't know how this works. But getting back to that tweet from Sunkissed PTA about what time the band shows up and all that sort of stuff. So on the North American tour, the band would show up around usually, I think, 2:30 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And at least one, I think at most of the shows, at least one, if not several members of the band would go over to the fans that were waiting outside the entrance, sign autographs, you know, quick conversation, that sort of stuff. Then they'd go in, they'd do their sound check. And then after the show, the band just, you know, pretty much takes off, you know, as soon as the show's over. Do they do that also for the European shows? Do they spend time chatting with fans beforehand? Is there, you know, a good area outside the arena, the arenas, where that can take place?
In my experience, the case has always been yes. They have come out, although generally I've usually climbed the fence to get to them, so I'm probably not doing the things which are generally legal, but it's always a way of getting to see them for sure. A couple of times I've been kindly thrown out of the venue sometimes doing that. So
oh, wow.
I wouldn't recommend it. But no, I mean, generally, they do tend to do the same thing on the European tours. And that's been my experience in Spain from just trying to think of other times I met U2 outside of England, signing autographs and whatever. It's usually 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock, a sound check for an hour. And then they usually, I presume, go back to the hotel and come back again for the show start. I mean, obviously this time around, it's going to be a little bit different because no support act playing. So I think that's probably going to catch a few people out. I'm not so sure whether some people will turn up. Certainly in the UK, they'll expect the main act to come on at 9 o'clock at night. And that's going to be quite different, obviously, for this tour. Certainly those who've got their tickets, or they better take some time reading that, because there's a chance some people may miss the start of the show. That's going to be the main difference, I think, for this time around. But the access to the band has generally been quite good over the years, and I hope that doesn't change.
I was just going to say, well, I'm curious to know if your experience with the shows you've seen is the same as what Aaron just described. But then I'd also, since you saw some of the four of the shows, I'd love your thoughts on the lack of an opening band this time. The fact that it's just, you know, just you two and nobody else.
Okay. Well, first coming to the pre-show, I have to say from the reports I've been reading and seeing, you know, all the tweets of the band showing up before the concert, I have a feeling this time around they're even taking more time for the fans to come out and sign autographs or take pictures. It's just, I mean, I'm a little forgetful, so honestly, maybe 4 or 5 years ago this was exactly the same. But it just, to me, it seems like, you know, every show at least two of them will show up and do something. And as of to the there no being opening act, it's a little strange. I have to stay in Vancouver, sitting down and seeing Dallas and everybody already just working it up and getting ready to play. I honestly do miss an opening act. I just feel like that's how a concert should be. It's just part of what you're going to see, that there's another band, and then you'll wait another hour and you're getting tired but also anxious. It's strange. And I know a lot of people expected you two to play longer just because there is no opening act, which to this day, the argument doesn't really settle with me, because just because there's no opening act, they never said that they're going to play for 3 hours now. Yeah, personally, I'd like to see one, but that's just my opinion. I feel like it changes the atmosphere a little bit.
Right. Which, when you got back from Vancouver, it was you and I think Dirk from your crew was there. Was anybody else in Vancouver?
From the crew, no, but there were a lot of people from board members, obviously, there, yeah.
Gotcha. So when you got back from Vancouver and you're chatting with your friends that are U2 fans, you're chatting with the other folks from U2Tour.D, what were the most common questions that they were asking you?
Some of the most common questions, you know, the ones you already addressed about, you know, where you're going to sit, it's one of the biggest questions, obviously, because up until recently, I think the seating plans or the seating charts are still not very accurate as to that you know exactly where you end up if you're sitting behind the stage or in front of the stage. So those were a lot of questions that people had on mind, and where the red zones are, when the band exactly started to play. It was most of the questions were around that, or when you should get there to, you know, stand front of stage, or you know, not be too far away from the stage. Those are the usual questions you'll have. Because everything else, let's be honest, nowadays you'll be able to see on YouTube anyway, and you'll be quick to judge if they're good or bad. But
one thing I was thinking about earlier, going back to the theme and what may change in Europe, I don't know. I think the band may yet play at least one track off No Line of the Horizon. I've been thinking about that, and probably Moment of Surrender is probably an opportunity for them to reintroduce that. That probably works thematically.
That's an interesting call, because I just happened to last week stumble across a, you know how you do a YouTube sort of rabbit trail from one video to the next and the next. And I was watching a Brian Eno video, which led me to an interview I hadn't seen of him talking about Moment of Surrender for 10 minutes or so and how they created it. And then into watching Moment of Surrender from, I think, the Rose Bowl, was it, that video? And yeah, it's a song that's a beautiful song that could play well in Europe as opposed to North America for some weird reason. It feels a little more European. That whole album feels a little more European-ish for some reason. I guess maybe Morocco. I don't know. But it'd be interesting because that's the one album that hasn't had a song represented, right? If we're,
I think there's just been a snippet, props. Yeah. Moment of Surrender. That's about it.
Yeah. He has snippeted Moment of Surrender a couple times. And I think I said on Twitter, I think I kind of made that same prediction, Aaron, that it wouldn't surprise me if they actually do that full song. Because Surrender is such, I mean, he talks about surrender, Bono does, talks about, you know, this idea of surrender several times throughout the show. And so it would, you know, logically make sense that that would be one potential, you know, song change that that they could introduce.
And it's
sort of being begged to being played, isn't it? Because he started off with a very small snippet. And that snippet during the 35-6 concert of the first leg, it just became longer and longer, and it stretched to like a minute and a half. And then they had two snippets. So I really think it's there. They're really almost there to play it. So I wouldn't be surprised if it pops up as well.
Yeah, I agree. So, Navid, before we wrap up here, do you want to give us sort of like a preview of what U2Tour.de is going to be doing in terms of covering the tour and all that sort of stuff? Because those of us here in North America that are not going to be able to make it over to Europe for any shows, we're going to be relying on you guys and the sites in France and Italy and et cetera, you know, all around Europe to sort of give us a taste of what's going on. So do you guys have a plan and an idea of what you guys are going to be doing?
We're going to have a full coverage of, of the second leg. We have, I think, if I'm not currently mistaken, almost any of the concert location will have at least one or two staff members, and we'll have plenty of people sending out tweets and whatnot for sure. We're also going to have a Berlin party, just like you had a couple of weeks ago in New York, and let's see if the guys show up or not.
I hope so.
We sure hope so. I'm sure we're going to be very, very active on Twitter and YouTube and everything. You're going to hear and be covered up with U2Tour.de for sure during the second leg of the entire tour.
Awesome. And how many shows and which, if you don't mind saying, are you personally going to?
Let me think. I'm going to the to both Turin concerts in Torino. I think another two in Berlin, two in London, two in Paris. It's eight, I guess. That's fixed for now. And anything else, you know, we'll just see what goes along the line.
That's cool. You'll get to track from the beginning to the end, just like you did here between Vancouver and New York.
Yeah, for sure.
Aaron Govern, we kind of know what At U2 is going to try to do with you and the rest of our crew in Europe and continue doing the same thing that we did in North America. But which shows are you going to? All six in London,
I've got all six in London. And it looks like I'm going to one of the Glasgow shows. I can't remember which one it is. I'm also hoping, of course, Dublin's going to be announced soon. At this point, it looks doubtful there may be a Dublin show if we're, you know, to believe the physicality of the stage and being able to fit it into what is now the Three Arena. And there's obviously some dates being mooted for Belfast. And I think Belfast actually deserves a concert. It's probably been Joshua Tree tour since they played indoors in Northern Ireland. So I don't know. I think there'll be a few more shows announced, and I think I'm looking forward to being able to go to some more shows for sure. With the benefit of hindsight, I wish I'd actually bought some more tickets for other countries this time around. It hasn't been this way. I mean, I did quite a few countries for Vertigo and for 360 Tour, but I found it a little bit more difficult to coordinate myself this year to get tickets for different shows. But we'll see.
Very cool. Thanks, guys. And I'll just make note that it wasn't Matt or I that brought up the At U2 20th party for the sixth consecutive episode. No, don't.
That was bound to happen at some point again.
I really can't believe that was mentioned again.
So take a shot or whatever. Mark your X on your At YouTube podcast official bingo chart or whatever. But thanks, Aaron, and thanks, Navid, for joining us on the At YouTube roundtable. And we'll put links to, if they want us to, in the show notes, so that folks can find them on Twitter and follow along. And of course, like Matt mentioned, atu2.com is where Aaron will be helping out. And then u2tours.de is where you can find more of Navid's stuff.
That's a real Zoo TV moment.
Okay, thanks, Aaron and Navid, for joining us on the At YouTube Roundtable. As always, if you have any follow-up questions, things we discussed, maybe you disagree, maybe you agree, maybe you're wanting more clarification, we still have one more episode before the European tour starts in Turin. And so if you have questions like that relevant to the tour or anything in general, ask at YouTube is the hashtag to use on Twitter, and we'll follow it find it and use it in a future episode. Don't be disheartened if we don't use your question in the very next episode. We try to sort of wrap a bunch together that are appropriate and match them to other discussions going on. And we save them all, though, until future dates. And so any closing remarks, Matt, from you on this episode?
No, that was fun. I enjoyed having, I mean, it's great that we expanded beyond the continent of North America, and we had Aaron on from, well, he was in the Dominican Republic, but he's, you know, from England, and we had Navid from u2tour.de. He was in Istanbul, he said. Holy Moses. So I'd love to get more guests on like that as we go forward. So hopefully, and we had Beth and Chris on last week, and so hopefully we'll just keep mixing things up. We'll have some guests on some weeks, and we'll have At U2 crew on, you know, sometimes. So yeah, fun stuff.
Yeah. I'll just make a brief mention of the atu2.com poll that's on right now, which is, which unplayed song from Songs of Innocence do you most hope gets played in concert during the Innocence and Experience tour? So obviously that carries over. I don't know how long the poll is going to be running for. Matt may sabotage it because one of the songs is Sleep Like a Baby Tonight. But right now they're in a pretty dead heat. 46% for Sleep Like a Baby and 53% for This Is Where You Can Reach Me Now, hoping to be played. So just for a little bit of fun, you can go vote and add to the discussion there. You can find the podcast here, like I mentioned earlier, goodstuff.fm/atu2/7 is this episode number. twitter.com/atu2 is the Twitter account. Ask atu2 is the hashtag. And facebook.com/atu2com is where you can find us on Facebook. And I think that's everything for this episode. Thank you so much for listening. Hope you have a great day. See you next time. Bye.
Pint.